Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and happy holidays. Welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080, 96.5 TICFM and Light 100.5 WRCH. Aaron Kupek with you this Sunday morning. This morning, an encore broadcast of some of our conversations with former University of Hartford archaeologist Richard Freund, who has joined us for years on the Sunday before Christmas to talk about the foundations of the holiday. It's a tradition we began here with Sam Gingerella, the longtime host of the program. We lost Sam in 2017, and Dr. Freund has moved on to Christopher Newport University in Virginia. But now some of our conversations over the past 2 years with Dr. Freund, a prominent archaeologist, historian, and explorer.
You know, Sam was very passionate about this show. Every year he would call me 2-3 months in advance, and he says, you remember, we're going to do the Christmas show. And every year I would come and I would talk to him. At the end of the show, I'd always say to him, you know, Sam, I do take volunteers. You can come with me to Israel, to Greece, to Spain. And he'd say, oh, I wish. So one of the things that as we remember Sam this day, as we talk about these excavations, is we should always say to ourselves, there is never a good time, okay? You should always think about trying to do these kinds of things. Because Sam really wanted to do this, and I wish he had done it. It would really have fulfilled a big circle for him.
And one of the things he was always interested in were the roots of Christmas and how they relate to Judaism.
Right. Every year we have the same discussion. He would ask me, and I think it is an important question. Where is it that Christmas comes from? Is there some kind of connection between the Jewish roots of Christmas? And I always would tell Sam that there was a unique understanding that I can give him about the Christmas. And that was that it is an unusual holiday that starts in the evening. Christmas starts in the evening before the day. Now, that in itself is one of the first connections to Jewish holidays. All Jewish holidays start in the evening and then continue through the next day. But the second thing, which was very important, is there was never in any early Christian calendar the idea that Jesus was born in the wintertime in December. So how did it get located onto this very specific date of the 24th into the 25th? And it seems that the easiest connection is through the holiday of Hanukkah. Hanukkah, which is the holiday of dedication of the temple, starts on the 25th day, actually in the 24th day, in the evening of the lunar month of Kislev. So the lunar month is actually different than the solar month. But the fact that it starts on the 24th and starts on the 25th, it really does connect us immediately with the numbering of the day. Second thing is the name of the holiday of Hanukkah is the holiday of lights. Everyone who has ever read the Christmas story and ever tried to figure out what is the deal with the lights that everybody has on their houses? Where does that come from in Christianity? That comes from a very, very, very arbitrary use of the idea that the lights that directed the Magi into. So therefore, we're in the middle of winter. It's good to have nice lights. But really, we think that the original purpose was that this was from the holiday of lights. The holiday of lights, which was Hanukkah. The lighting of the candles that were for the rededication of the temple. And finally, the interesting thing about this this holiday is that Jesus would never have been able, in swaddling cloth, to have been outside in a cave near Bethlehem in this time of the year. this time of the year near Jerusalem and Bethlehem are very cold with snowing. So the idea that the people would have been visiting and going, and this was the time of the tax collection, that's why they went down to Bethlehem, because they really live in Nazareth. All of this is connected to a very specific transformation, a morphing, if you will, of a holiday from Judaism that got new meaning in Christianity, but only three or four centuries after Jesus was no longer walking the face of the earth.
Bring us back to the first Christmas. What is supported by science and the artifacts, and what isn't?
You know, I have to tell you that a lot of people for a good long time have questioned some of the earliest narratives we have. You know, what was Jesus of Nazareth doing in Bethlehem for his birth? I mean, he's from Nazareth. Why is he going to Bethlehem, which is hundreds of miles away? And, you know, these kinds of things, we've now started to reveal the reasons for a lot of these things through archaeology. So now we know that there was a census that was the Roman census that took place usually in the springtime, not necessarily in December, when it was very cold and the roads were inundated. But there was a census every year. And the family of Mary and Joseph was probably from Judea in Bethlehem in the south of the country. And they may have been living in Nazareth because there's a lot of good jobs there. And they went back to their original town for the census. And, of course, she gives birth to Jesus. The story of Christmas is very complicated also. I mean, being born on December 25th is a very, very complicated thing, since if you're in a manger, you're going to be very cold in Judea at that time period. But what's more important is some elements like the Annunciation, which takes place 6 months before, 9 months before, where she's being told by the angel Gabriel that Mary is going to have this child, Jesus. So the question is, do we have any evidence of the Holy Family being in a place like Nazareth in this time period? And now we have more evidence than we had before. There was, for a long time, a lot of people said that there was very little evidence of a settlement in the city of Nazareth, which is modern-day Israel in the north in Galilee. And recently, we've had excavations of the Mary's Well, which we also did. And we've discovered that this public well has been there for thousands of years, and in the well were actually artifacts. And the artifacts tell us that there were people there, because we find coins and we find ceramics and we find glass and things that can be very specifically dated to the first century. So in general, archaeology is doing a pretty good job in developing this whole storyline of what is accurate in the Gospels about the story of Christmas.
Following Christmas, of course, is Three Kings Day. What evidence is there to suggest that occurred?
Each one of these elements are obviously elements that were added to the church calendar over years. So I'm not going to be taking each element in the church calendar. What is very interesting, for example, is a lot of people think that the original symbol of Christianity, everybody thinks it's a cross, and this is the cross upon which Jesus was crucified. In fact, the earliest archaeological evidence of Christianity, the symbols of Christianity, was the fish, because this is a symbol of the profession of the apostles that Jesus was recruiting at the Sea of Galilee. They were fishermen, and a lot of people think that that fish also may actually give us the original meaning of the cross. We look at the cross and we associate it, of course, with the crucifixion. But archaeological evidence from early Christianity and from this first and second century and into the third century context suggested that original cross may not be a cross at all. It may actually be an anchor. And some of the earliest crosses that are being used by Christians are not just crosses that look like crucifixes, meaning the place where Jesus died, but rather are anchors. And they have a little bottom to the cross that sort of dropped off other people's renderings of the cross. So this is the beauty of archaeology, because what it provides us is a totally different resource for understanding the origins of religion and history, and that's what's great about it. From year to year, I never know what we're going to discover. You know, the one thing that we can say about Christmas is that the first calendar that was developed by the new Byzantine government was only in the 4th century. And the symbols of Christianity were totally changed by the 4th century. In the 1st century and in the 2nd century, the symbols of Christianity were the fish. This was a symbol of the occupation of the apostles. By the 4th century, though, they totally changed it, and they made it into the crucifix. This idea of the crucifixion would have been absolutely incomprehensible to 1st and 2nd century Christians. So you can see how Christianity built itself in the 4th century, and that's why Christmas occupies such an important place in this new Christianity that develops in the Byzantine Empire.
You have also been working at the Church of the Annunciation in Nazareth.
Right. And I have to say, this is Sam and I had this conversation I was working 15 years on this project. And what we discovered was in the Greek Orthodox Church of the Annunciation, by the way, there are two churches of the Annunciation in Nazareth. For those of you who are wondering what the Church of the Annunciation tradition is, this is where Mary, mother of Jesus, has this announcement of the birth of Jesus in Nazareth. Now, Jesus's mother and father, Joseph and Mary, were from Nazareth. And so we always call him Jesus of Nazareth. Well, the event, which was the announcement of the birth of Jesus, took place in Nazareth. By the way, 6 months before, it had to be 6 months before Christmas, so that we're talking about the idea of the way they understood the gestation period. So Jesus is born in Nazareth, lives in Nazareth until, of course, he ends his days in Jerusalem. But the Church of the Annunciation is built by the Greek Orthodox on top of a fountain, an area where there's water. Why is that so important? Because it says, not in the canonical New Testament, but in the writings written by early Christians, that it took place, the announcement of the birth of Jesus took place with Mary at the well. And the angel Gabriel came to her and said, "You will have a child, and he will be Jesus. He will be the Messiah." So we were excavating around the church, and again, using non-invasive means, because we don't want to destroy a 1,500-year-old church. And I said to the bishop, I said, "You have something about 6 feet below the present church. If you'd like, we can excavate that." And of course, we don't want to rip up a 1,500-year-old church. So we started excavations in the back, and we found the original church floor that goes back literally to the time when first churches were being built in Israel by Queen Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great. And to find the original floor of this original church in Nazareth is something near spectacular, because the church has been destroyed multiple times, rebuilt multiple times. And down the street from the Greek Orthodox Church is the Basilica, where the house of Mary and Joseph is inside of the Roman Catholic Church of the Annunciation. So right now, after working 15 years in Nazareth, they're going to be reconstructing the original floor area of this original church of the Church of the Annunciation. So one summer, I got to do Atlantis, I got to do the Holocaust, and the origins of Christianity in archaeology.
You are listening to Face Connecticut, an encore edition with Dr. Richard Freund, former University of Hartford archaeologist, now leader of the Judaic Studies program at Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia.
Tell us the story of Matilda Olkin.
Oh, and you know, one of the things that the University of Hartford has become very well known for is that we take students into the field every summer, sometimes in the winter, and we do excavations. So last year, in 2018 summer, we had this opportunity to go, and we went back to Lithuania. We're excavating the Great Synagogue of Lithuania, and a group from northern Lithuania came to us and said, we have this very famous Jewish poet who was murdered by the Nazis, and we'd like to find where she's buried. We have eyewitnesses. Can you help us? So we've sort of made this a cause célèbre that we're able to go into the field using ground penetrating radar. If we have eyewitnesses, we usually use, for example, also photographs. We have captured Nazi photograph flyovers of most of the areas of places like Lithuania. And we then look to see if we can find it, lost synagogues, lost cemeteries, and in this case, mass burials. Now, Matilda Olkin was the equivalent of the Anne Frank of Lithuania. She wrote, she was already a teenager, and she was murdered before she was 20 years old in the field, in the forest. And her diaries only were discovered in the last few years. And they were discovered under the great altar of a church where she lived. One of the local Roman Catholic priests saved her diaries, hid them underneath the altar, and now they were being translated. And her poetry is the equivalent of one of the great poets that we know, and Lithuanians are very, very much interested in her poetry. She wrote in Lithuanian, but she is, in that sense, the quintessential figure for Lithuanians to understand the relationship between the Holocaust and their own national identity. So we went out this past summer with the eyewitnesses, and we found her mass burial where she was buried. Now, you know, I'll tell you, Anne Frank, who was a great diarist, younger, we don't know where she's buried. She died in an extermination camp, and no one knows where she is. But to find Matilda Olkin gave my students a great sense that they can go out and do something and make a positive contribution towards the understanding of the Holocaust. And in this case, they're making a documentary at the University of Hartford. Students at the University of Hartford are making a documentary about her. And it really is a great use of how to educate people about how to use geoscience, because we're not digging up Matilda Olkin. We're marking her grave. So we're using geoscience, we're using archaeology, we're using history together to help educate students and I think the public about all these issues.
So many of your discoveries have been made using ground-penetrating radar. That has really been a game-changer, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, we use two techniques. Ground-penetrating radar and electrical resistivity tomography that basically gives us an MRI of the ground. And so we can then decide what's there before sticking a spade into the earth. And that's been a game changer for a lot of different archaeology, because I hate to tell you the dirty secret of archaeology is destructive. It's expensive. It's labor intensive. It's pretty ineffective. And it sometimes is insensitive. In the case of the Holocaust, it's just impossible to really excavate most of these sites. We have to just find them, mark them, and so there's no development going on. But even in the case of the Church of the Annunciation, we don't want to rip up the floor of the Church of the Annunciation. We want to know where we can excavate and find the things without destroying those things that are sacred, important to the people that are there. So we can work with ground penetrating radar in someone's business, office, house, find what's there, tell them what's there, excavate in a pinpoint fashion, and then extract artifacts and then close it up so people can go on with their business. And that's a big difference than the way archaeology was done 50 years ago.
And you're going to be using this radar through ice.
Oh, yes. This in January, I'm going back to Lithuania to find a ghost shtetl, a missing settlement that was inundated after the war by the Soviets. An entire Jewish village, after the people were murdered, the Soviets decided after the war that they needed to create a dam. They created the dam, and they inundated the whole village. It's called Rumsiskus, and it's on the campus of the Living Museum of Lithuania, the Williamsburg of Lithuania. And we're going to go back. We're going to see this winter whether it's there. If it is there, we're going to go back with divers to see what can be excavated out of that village.
When do you make the decision to go from the non-invasive archaeology to actually excavating?
Well, for example, I mean, we worked at this great synagogue of Vilna for 3 years, just doing non-invasive materials and then doing some pinpoint archaeology. And then we decided that we needed to do full-scale excavations of the place. There are no people buried there. It is just the great synagogue of Vilna. It was, for Jews, the equivalent of the Vatican. It was the size of 2 football fields, and it was buried underneath an elementary school in downtown Vilnius in Lithuania. So, you know, we worked with the municipality, with the government. They allowed us to do some small excavation. But after we took out 100,000 artifacts, they decided to close the school, and now we're excavating the entire Great Synagogue. So sometimes you start small, you do non-invasive, and it does lead to bigger things. We started out non-invasively at the Church of the Annunciation, and what it led to was full-scale excavations, and now they're building a church on top of our excavations, and they put a glass floor on top of our excavations, so people who come into this new Church of the Annunciation will be able to see what it is that we've excavated, to see the original church.
What level of interest among today's college students is there in archaeology? Would you say it's growing? Or?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I've been teaching for 35 years, and I take students out to the field. A lot of people are very down on millennials, and they're very down on Generation Z, because they don't want to read books. But I can say, having done this now for 35 years, that this is the best generation of students in the field that I've ever had. When you take them out to the field where they can smell it, they can taste it, they can experience it, this is what millennials want to do. They don't want to read about it in a book. They want to discover it for themselves. And they are the best, the most curious generation of students that I've had. Then you can take them back to the classroom afterwards, and they're very interested about reading about it. But you first got to take them by the hand into the field where they can experience it for themselves. And so I got great hopes because of that.
He is Dr. Richard Freund, archaeologist, historian, and explorer, formerly at the University of Hartford, now with Christopher Newport University in Virginia. Our thanks to Dr. Freund, and thank you for listening to Face Connecticut. Enjoy the balance of your weekend, and Merry Christmas. Please join us again next week. I'm Aaron Kupek.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with autopay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without autopay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.